But until we get there, let's keep that the goal. And in the meantime, let's keep saving as many lives as is possible.
Welcome to Christ in Culture, the podcast of the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Here we'll explore how the Christian faith intersects all avenues of today's culture through conversations with leading thinkers. Welcome to the conversation.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Christ in Culture. I'm Nathaniel Williams, the editor and content manager here at the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture. In today's episode, Dr. Keith Lee will talk with Brent Leatherwood and Miles Mullen of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. Their conversation touches on the public square, on gun violence, and on patriotism. So this conversation is going to serve as a combination of our headlines and our Christ in Culture conversation segments today. After that, we will have another edition of our segment called On My Bookshelf. One final note before we hop into the conversation with Brent Leatherwood and Miles Mullen, we would love to hear your feedback. Give us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, or you can go to our website and contact us there on the contact form on our About page, or you can follow us on social media at SEBTS Bush Center. Now, let's jump into our conversation with Brent Leatherwood and Miles Mullen.
What does it look like for Christians to be faithful in the public square? Well, here today with us is Brent Leatherwood and Miles Mullen. Brent serves as president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for the Southern Baptist Convention, and Miles serves as vice president and chief of staff for the ERLC. Brent, Miles, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. This visit to Southeastern is my first time here, and I'm just loving this campus and just the culture that y'all hear at this institution.
Well, thank you. We've loved having you here, and hopefully we'll have you back here many more times in the upcoming days. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your journey of how you journeyed through politics and ended up at the ERLC. Where did you start?
You want me to go, Miles, or you first, how you got to the ERLC? Yours is a lot more succinct.
Yeah. So I'm thrilled to be back on campus. I'm a 2001 graduate, and my life and ministry and faith
as a 2000 graduate
was you were the pastor of Open Door Baptist Church when I was here as a student.
That's right.
I was just thrilled to be here during that time and had a solid public education, but really this school shaped my trajectory in terms of loving the Bible and just Baptist theology.
So did you go straight into the ERLC?
I did not. So I'll just tell you a little bit of my story. I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley on the border in McAllen, Texas. I came to know the Lord when I was 8 at a revival service, but because my mother had talked to me about the gospel up to that point, went to the University of Virginia where I met my wife in Campus Crew. What was then Campus Crusade for Christ is now Crew. And we've been married 30 years, have 2 adult children. We love being empty nesters. We miss the kids, but it's a lot of fun to just have time together as well. We enjoy each other. Graduated from this institution, Southeastern Seminary, with an MDiv in Biblical Language, and then pursued a PhD at Vanderbilt in Historical Study of Religion. And then from there, went to serve 10 years at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary's Houston campus, where one of the highlights of my teaching career was teaching in the prison program there.
Were you with John Lang?
Yes, I was with John Lang. John and I are still good friends. And John and Stefana both are actually
great people.
Good friends.
Great people. Glad to hear that story. Tell us then, how did you end up then from there?
I served 7 years at Hannibal LaGrange University in Northeast Missouri, where I was most of that in executive leadership and then as faculty member in charge of some special projects, and served as a trustee on the board for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission back when Dr. Moore was still president, and then got to know Brent a little bit in that capacity and went from Hannibal LaGrange University into work with the Missouri Baptist Convention in church revitalization.
In Jefferson City?
In Jefferson City. Yes. Expected I'd do that for a while. Was actually only there 6 months when Brent called and said, hey, I've been praying about something and I'd like you to pray about it too. And I said, I'm really happy with my job right now, but I've committed to be I used to be a no first kind of guy. I've committed to be a pray first kind of guy. And so we started talking about that, and I came in February of 2023.
Mm-hmm. So from Texas to Virginia to Southeastern to Tennessee to Missouri, now back to Tennessee. Yeah, mm-hmm. you keep you're a nomad.
Yeah, so we've lived in a major metro.
And I appreciate that because it takes one to know one.
Yeah, yeah. We've lived in a major metropolitan area, Houston, and then in rural Missouri, and just kind of goes to Brent's philosophy about political engagement as well. It's like kind of bloom where you're planted and see how you can engage in your community mm-hmm. as best you can.
That's good.
Bringing him aboard to the team really speaks to, you know, what I want to cultivate in our team is obviously really good research background. He's got the chops, obviously, to help lead an institution. But then he also has a heart for the local church. And that's what you will find throughout our team is we want to help pastors. We want to help people in the pews who are struggling or looking at or curious about the issues of the day in the public square. And that's really what brought me to the ERLC. So I think let me back up and say this first and foremost. So I'm married to my wife, 12 years. We have three children. We've lived in Tennessee throughout that time. And I'm a deacon at my local church. And, you know, as probably many folks in your audience know, deacons, we're the helpers in the church. We go around and we look for ways to serve. And that sort of servant leadership, that mindset is really what I'm trying to at least be known for if I can. And I came to the ERLC back January 1st, 2017. Russell Moore was the president, and he called me not long after the 2016 election and said, you know, we don't have a spot here necessarily, but really would love for you to come over and join mm-hmm. the team. And that really was the culmination of a relationship that had been years in the making, where I had been introduced through a former colleague, Andrew Walker, who now is at Southern. He was on the staff then, and I just found him saying some things online that I agreed with, and we ended up meeting for coffee, and next thing I knew, I was introduced to all these wonderful people at the ERLC, including Russell Moore. And
were you living in Tennessee at the time?
I was in Nashville. I was actually running the Tennessee Republican Party. And so that's really my background. My background is policy and electoral politics. And so right after I graduated, I was thankful. Thankfully, I was able to secure a spot on a statewide campaign down in Florida, campaign for U.S. Senate. And from there, I went to a U.S. House campaign. Was able to work in the United States Congress as a senior legislative aide on Capitol Hill. Then, after doing that for about 3.5 years, was able to head back to Tennessee, did some work for small businesses, and then ran some more campaigns mm-hmm. and ended up at the legislature running the communications for the House majority. And so that's just like, you know, my background briefly. But what we found in those early conversations between the ERLC team and myself is just how much what the ERLC was working on was helpful for my work and the kind of information I could share with them about what was going on over in the political world. And when I got that call to potentially join the team, I was praying with Meredith about it. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, we absolutely should pray about this, but I remember you telling me back in April of 2015, if you ever had the chance to work at the ERLC, you would jump at the opportunity. So I think we just need to pray that this is confirmation."
Yeah.
That,
in other words, you pray while I pack.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really appreciate about what you bring to the ERLC, if we were to use Baptist lingo, you're a Baptist layman.
Mm-hmm. I'm a churchman.
Yeah. Yep. And I think you bring a wonderful perspective, particularly since you've had the kind of political and legislative experience. Which last night, as you spoke at the CFC for the Carver Barnes lecture, you talked about serving in the public square. Mm. What were you trying to get across to the audience last night?
Well, I think probably at a very, you know, basic level, I was trying to help people understand that it's okay. When you say public square, most people immediately jump to politics, and that makes sense. But I think I'm trying to help people have a more expansive view of the public square. Because when you do that, A, it just makes it more relatable and it makes it easier to access as opposed to something that's distant and far off in places like Washington, D.C. or maybe your state capital. Because when you start to understand that the conversations that you have with coworkers or the informational meeting that you attend after a church service or the ways that you can interact with your neighbors, those all have political dimensions to them. And that's okay. We shouldn't run from that.
You said even baptism is a political
statement. That's right. That's right. Well, I think baptism as for a Christian is the most basic and powerful political declaration you can make because you are saying, I am giving my life to a Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and I'm not giving it to some earthly king. And that's that is at its heart inherently a political act. And I think that we need to understand the ramifications that should have because when Jesus calls us to follow him, he calls us to follow him in all directions and in all aspects of our life.
Yeah. In the first century, to say Jesus is Lord rather than Caesar is Lord, as you pointed out, that was such a powerful thing that we're blessed in this country to have such religious liberty that perhaps we don't quite understand what it means to confess Jesus as Lord in a hostile environment. We have on our campus those who have been converted from an Islamic setting, and for them to follow the Lord in believer's baptism put them at odds with everything in their culture, and what a statement it was for them to make. So I really appreciated you bringing that out. You talked about the risk of idolatry.
Right.
Unpack that just a little bit. What are the idols that we have to be aware of?
Right. Well, so that was the one of the chief points in my remarks last night is that we are continually faced with these various idols in our life and fashioning them into things that we end up following. And for a Christ follower, it shouldn't be that way. Just look at what all is out there. The idolatry of individualism, thinking that you alone set the course of your life, or some sort of radical autonomy that you're removed from a community around you, sexual gratification. There's all these idols that we are fashioning in our life, and that's especially true in politics. And to go back to something that you referenced from last night too. So to say that Jesus is Lord is to say that Caesar is not. For our Baptist forebears, right, to say that Jesus is Lord meant that the King of England is not. And right up to this moment, to say that Jesus is Lord means that neither Joe Biden or Donald Trump are. And so we need to make sure whether it's individuals or things that in and of themselves are not bad, but it's once you start fashioning them into an idol and that becomes the thing you worship— Well, then we need to start talking about the violations of the First and Second Commandment.
Speaking of the First and Second Commandment and being people of faith and of firm convictions, operating in a public square, which is, we have the blessing of being involved in a democracy, and yet in a democratic system, compromise is a central feature. So one of the questions that was brought up last night, and I thought it was a very good one, and that is how does one stay true to his or her principles while at the very same time understanding that they're in an incremental process,
right.
A process in which victories may just be measured in inches rather than miles. You've been involved in this process on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen it from the inside, and you're dealing with it now as someone representing Southern Baptist. How do we do that well?
Well, I think we need to step back, and there's an old saying in politics that applies in other areas. When you're thinking through a policy, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I just like that phrase because that's often the choice that we are facing. in any number of deliberations, right? Some sort of policy that's out there that we're thinking through, some sort of ballot initiative. And you're right. We live in this world where I think there's a high value for incrementalism. And SBC President Bart Barber, we like to joke about that. And we were talking one day about this very thing. And he said that incrementalism is more than just a strategy for accomplishing good. I view it actually as a mode of leadership. And he was kind of using it in reference to conservatism. We don't just take these big, bold stands. We actually make sure that what we're doing is right and it comports with truth and justice. And, you know, it often plays out in the context of, you know, for example, abortion policy, mm-hmm. where you're trying to push back against this pro-choice regime that has been set up by the abortion industry. And, you know, I try and tell people, take ground where you're able.
Right.
So if a policy, I mean, right here in North Carolina is a perfect example. For so long, North Carolina has had an abortion ban beginning at 20 weeks. And then last year, there were two competing proposals, one for 12 weeks, and I believe the other was 6 weeks. 6 weeks is obviously better than 12 weeks. We would love to get there. But the reality of the moment was that did not have the support to advance and, more precisely, override a governor's veto, mm-hmm. which the governor here threatened both of those with a veto. But at 12 weeks, you could get enough support to override his veto. And we at the RLC worked with the North Carolina Baptists once the legislature moved that 12-week abortion ban, to call attention to it because the governor did what he said he was going to. He vetoed it and then made sure that the moral case was made for why legislators should override this veto. And they did. And guess what? Now we're in a state where more lives are saved than they were previously. Are we satisfied with that? No. We want to live in a day where abortion is completely eradicated, where babies' lives are saved. And mothers are supported and families can grow and develop. Like we yearn for that day. We long for that day. But until we get there, let's keep that the goal. And in the meantime, let's keep saving as many lives as is possible. And so I think that's how you do it. And none of that, as you articulate and advocate and fight for these things, it doesn't mean you're somehow compromising on your principles. You're just doing what you are able to, and any bill that saves an additional life is worthy of support for Christians, because we understand the inherent dignity by these preborn image bearers, and we need to protect them.
That was well said, and I appreciate how clearly you explained that. Let's move now from policy to something personal. A little over a year ago, I guess now, in Nashville— there was a shooting incident, and it impacted you personally. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Yeah. So, it was a murderous rampage. Is what it was. Before I get to that, let me relay a conversation I had with a pastor on the south side of Chicago, not too long before this happened on March 27th. And I was talking with this pastor, and there was some sort of, I don't know, drama going around in SBC life, as there usually is. And I was just talking with this pastor about that, and he said, you know, the context that I'm in, this church that I've planted and have helped shepherd now for many years. We watch those debates that you have in Nashville or Louisville or Wake Forest or wherever, and those are fine. I've got some opinions on that, but I got to be honest. The number one thing that I'm facing here with my church is how to help a family that just lost a child to a random gang shooting.
Right.
How to help a grandmother bury a grandchild because of some senseless random act of gunfire in a neighborhood. Those are the things that I'm dealing with because it is routine that we will have somebody in church on one Sunday, and the next Sunday, they're not there anymore because they were gunned down. And that's what I'm dealing with. And that spoke to me in the moment in the sense of it gave me a greater perspective of all the various challenges that our pastors are facing. But this one pastor was saying there's more like me out there than you realize, right, who are dealing with this on a daily basis. And, you know, I just kind of stored that up in my heart and started thinking, well, is there a way that we can speak out on this and share the burden that this pastor is carrying? And then not too long after that, a deranged individual dressed up as if she was, you know, some sort of army ranger decided to shoot her way into my children's school and committed the worst school shooting in Tennessee history. Six innocent lives lost, three of them children. Two of them had just been 10 minutes prior with my oldest child in the school. And as anyone can imagine with the sudden loss of life in a community, there's a lot of trauma that comes with that. My youngest was outside and initially heard the gunshots and was able to flee. My two oldest were in down the hallway where the vast majority of shots were fired. I mean, they heard all 152 shots that this shooter unloaded in the school. And that, you know, as a father, there are no words to understand the depths of fear and sorrow that you have to shepherd your children through as they recover, and you yourself have to deal with. I mean, the teachers and the administrators that were lost, those were dear friends, and the children that were lost, these were fellow parents that, you know, we routinely saw at school events. And so it's a long road. Probably the thing I've learned is that prior to this, I thought trauma and recovery from trauma was a kind of a linear process, and it is much more varied than that. It is up and down. It surfaces at random moments without any sort of seeming in the mind of a child prompting, as you're, you know, thinking about what on earth just happened that my child is all of a sudden back in that moment. Yeah. So anyways, thinking through, stepping back from that in our home and thinking through the responsibilities that we have as an organization or ways that we can support our churches who have dealt with this, I would say for those who think about gun violence and mass shootings, there's a few ways to enter this discussion and realize that you are not some sort of raging extremist if you're pointing out that this is a problem and something needs to be done about it. One, at a basic level, the Southern Baptist Convention has actually passed on two different occasions resolutions calling for elected officials and leaders in our nation, in our states, and at the local level to take steps to address this and to end this crisis. And it truly is a crisis. I mean, for example, in my home state of Tennessee, the number one killer of children is guns. Hmm. Now, the vast majority of them are easy fixes. Responsible gun ownership, right. Just making sure that children, as they're walking around a home, maybe kind of unnoticed, don't happen upon a firearm,
right,
and then inadvertently shoot themselves. Like that's what happens in so many cases. And so just steps to mitigate those instances would cause that loss of innocent life to just collapse, and we should want that. And then for these situations, like we faced at Covenant, we should not want deranged people to have the ability to just come in and kill children.
Right.
Like that's like a basic human principle. And you can say that and both hold fast and want to protect the Second Amendment, That is a false choice to think that those two things cannot coexist together, that we should keep these deadly firearms from people who are facing severe mental illness and also want to make sure that the government does not violate our Second Amendment rights. Like, those things can happen. I was talking with a former senator, actually former majority leader, who's also a medical professional, and he pointed out that in so many of these situations of mass shootings, the perpetrators, days, weeks, sometimes even years in advance, they send out these signals that are essentially cries for help.
Right.
And they're asking for intervention. They're asking for someone to please give me some kind of support before I take my own life or the lives of others. And if you're looking for some sort of theological or more broadly philosophical argument, just take the tenets that we use each and every day that we're so that just overflow out of us, our pro-life principles, and apply them in this context. Because I've worked with so many pro-life supporters, pro-life Christians, pro-life activists over the years, and they want to do everything they can to save every life possible. And we should bring that same tenacity to this challenge.
So you say pro-life. I've heard some people say what we need to do is have maybe a conversation about whole life. What does it look like to actually care for the human person and his or her dignity from the womb all the way up until the time they're in an assisted living? What does that look like at each of the stages? And I really appreciate what you had to say there about the Second Amendment. As somebody who owns guns personally, I understand. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as an American, I have the Second Amendment. As a Christian, I have the Second Commandment, you know, to love my neighbors myself. Mm. So how I'm hoping that people of goodwill can have a conversation that is not looking upon the other with suspicion.
Right.
In such a way that a conversation can be had that doesn't automatically go to the polarized extremes.
That's right.
How do we do that? That seems to be something we're struggling with in this day. I mean, it is this on this very day that we're recording this. The mother and father of the young man, I think it was in Michigan, that, you know, who gave every kind of warning signal there could be.
Right.
And so now the parents are being found derelict in their responsibilities.
Right.
I don't know what the sentencing is going to be, but this goes to the point of having the kind of responsibility in dealing with either access to guns across the board. Because to your point, most gun violence isn't the flashy, dramatic acts of terrorism. Most fatalities are from handguns, either unfortunately, suicide or accident.
That's right.
Or most acts of violence. Like I said, you know, if a robbery is going to be committed, it's probably not going to be done with an AR-15.
Right.
It's going to be done with a pistol. So how do we think well about these things? So, Miles.
In general, I would say one of the things that we need to do is get away from a culture of suspicion and just fear of having conversations. And one of the things that we've emphasized under Brent's leadership is to bring hope to the public square. And I think that has a twofold meaning. Like, it's a hope. We bring the hope of Jesus into the public square, and we want to tell people that we engage in at all levels of the public square about Jesus Christ and how he is the hope of the world, how he is their hope. Mm. But also, and I've seen Brent do this with reporters, and he just turns to the gospel in conversations with them, and it's compelling. But also, we bring hope. Because we're a hopeful people, we bring an optimism to our efforts that we can achieve something working with others in society for the common good because we have that hopefulness in Christ. I think there's a theological element to that too, and that has to do with common grace, and that you know, non-believers can see to some degree what is in the interest of the common good. And we as believers should be the ones to help shepherd that and to discern that and to move that forward. And this goes back to something Brent said earlier about, you know, moving the ball forward incrementally where at all possible, is that one of the things I've learned from Brent is, like, we can partner with whoever if the policy or the idea is good. We can partner with whoever if it moves the ball forward on something that's good for the common good, if it's good for society. We're in a cultural moment, though, where a lot of people don't see that as possible. Mm-hmm. Because if you can't partner with so-and-so because they take this position on X, Y, or Z.
Right.
And there's this and that means you're tainted or you've compromised. Well, no, we can partner with them on this thing because this thing is good. Mm. And I think bringing a hopefulness and an optimism that we can get back to some meaningful dialogue that is helpful to our society and promotes the common good for the flourishing of all people is something that I think Christians should be about, that Christians should embody.
Excellent. Brent, as we close out this segment, last night you talked about prophetic patriotism. Mm. Can you talk, just as we close, can you talk briefly what you meant by that? Whenever you called for a prophetic patriotism.
Well, I think it is right and proper and biblical for us to love and seek the good of where God has planted us, the cities where he has put us and the nation where he has put us. But to circle back to the beginning, if that becomes an idol, then we've gone too far, because we are Americans best when we are actually Christians first.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets to a little bit of what Miles was just saying. We should be seeking the common good consistent with principles of truth and justice as articulated in Scripture, as we know them as Christ followers, because we know that that will end up benefiting our neighbors all around us, those that we can see and those that we can't see. And it's just like we read about in Jeremiah, what the Lord told the Israelites to do in the context of living in Babylon, which had just destroyed their cities. And he said to plant gardens, to marry, to have sons and daughters and give them in marriage, and to seek the good of the city where I've planted you. So they were in a context that was oppressive.
Yeah.
And yet they were still called to seek the good of this society where they found themselves. And that should be the case for us as well in a context where we have so many wonderful rights that we get to call on as Americans. And so this shouldn't be hard for us. And we have to risk, though, not turning our love and devotion to our country into some sort of idol that gets in our way of first and foremost following Jesus.
Southeastern understands that you have a strategic and valuable role to play in getting the gospel to your neighbors and the nations. That's why we offer over 40 degrees at the undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral levels to equip you to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. Visit SEBTS.edu to learn more.
Now it's time for On My Bookshelf, the part of the show where our guests share what they're reading right now. So, Brent, Miles, what's on your bookshelf?
I'll give you three things right now that are on my nightstand.
Are you one of those guys that read about half a dozen books at a time?
Yes, he is. Which I think drives my wife nuts, because there's random books just lying
all around. On the night shelf, on the floor, right?
Yeah.
The three things that are on my nightstand right now. So one is Scripture. We're in Deuteronomy right now, leading my life group at church through Deuteronomy. And we just went through Deuteronomy 9 through 12. So next Sunday we'll be in Deuteronomy 13. So that's one. And the second is The Great Dechurching, written by Jim Davis, Michael Graham, and Ryan Burge, who is just great with statistical analysis, and trying to understand why there's been a large group of people who have either left the church, not returned, and I'm just fascinated by some of that statistical analysis. That's something that was cultivated in my days in politics, looking over polls and survey results, and so that one is just endlessly fascinating. And then the last one is an old one. It's about I think, 25 years old. It's from...
Oh, that's old.
Yeah. Well, book...
As someone who reads the patristics, I have to say...
That's right. But it's from noted historian Alan Gelzo, and it's The Redeemer President, about President Lincoln.
Yeah.
And I pretty much read anything about Abraham Lincoln, and certainly Gelzo is just incredible on our 16th president. So that's what's on my nightstand.
Yes, those are great selections. And Miles, how about yourself?
I am reading a couple things right now. I'm reading The Accidental President, Harry Truman and the 4 Months That Changed the World by A.J. Boehm, who wrote the book Go Like Hell, which is what the movie Ford versus Ferrari is based upon. Mm. And Truman and George H.W. Bush are two favorite 20th century presidents. I was an international politics major in college, and both of those guys stepped into – so my affection for them is not necessarily domestic, although some of it might be. My appreciation for them is both of them stepped into incredibly uncertain, tumultuous global times. Truman, the end of World War II, the beginning of the Cold War. George H.W. Bush, the decline and breakup of the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, and navigated those very, very well, and admire them very much.
As a native Missourian, I affirm wholeheartedly your selection of Truman.
Yeah, and Truman, just his, like, I mean, he was involved with the Pendergrass machine, yes, but he just kept making the next step, very unassuming, very humble guy, and ended up being president. And it's kind of an American story in that regard.
Excellent choices, both of you. How can people follow your work?
I'd say go to erlc.com, to our website. That's the first thing. We're going to have a new website that's going to drop sometime in May, and that's going to be much more accessible and easier to search, and it'd be very – it's user-first. It's audience – it's user-friendly, audience-facing. You can sign up for our newsletter there and say listen to our podcast. We just finished up our podcast. We did Gender and Sexuality in the fall. We did a series on life in the winter, spring, and we're just beginning on political engagement. So our podcast and all the podcast platforms, where those can be found.
And Light Magazine.
And Light Magazine.
Light Magazine.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
So the website is the abbreviation for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. So it's erlc.com.
That is correct.
That's right.
Excellent. Brent, Miles, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Keithley. Appreciate you very much.
It's great to be here.
Well, folks, thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, let us know. Follow us on social media at SCBTS Bush Center and leave a rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. We'll see you next week.